Hi, my name is... Hi, my name is Priscilla Awesome, but everybody calls me Pan with an N. I'm 77 years old as of last month. Today's date is Monday, October 7th, 2019. We're in Memphis, Tennessee. The name of my interview partner is Marilyn Connor, and she is my friend and colleague.
Hi, my name is Marilyn Connor. I am 74 years old as of last month. Today's date is Monday, October the 7th, 2019. We are in Memphis, Tennessee. My interview partner is Pan Awesome. We are friends and colleagues.
We are part of the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis, which was founded about 5 years ago now and is based on the work of Brian Stevenson, who has challenged people across the country, communities across the country, to memorialize and to honor lynching victims in their respective counties. And both Marilyn and I have been working on this together for several years now. And we decided to do this and to know each other more deeply because this project, for me, has impacted and clarified my life's purpose and meaning. So we're doing what we can. I'm doing what I can to fulfill, then live into my life's purpose. Marilyn, how about you?
I believe I am too. I have been told and have, and it has felt very true about my life's purpose, and my work in the Lynching Sites Project has deepened my thoughts about it, has increased my knowledge about it, has given me hope that, like every human, I'd like to do something while I'm here. I'd like to do something that might help somebody, or not even anything grandiose, but something to help somebody while I'm here.
We were both talking the other day about not wanting to exclusively play bridge or golf or take days just to do self-centered things, but that community really needs to come together, coalesce, and we need to be part of, I need to be part of that community, and we need to help our community grow. And Memphis is my adopted community. Going back to early years, I come from New York City, and my mother comes from New York City. And we come from very highly educated families, kind of what you would call the WASPy blue bloods. Both my parents were Ivy League graduates. Both their parents on my mother's and father's sides were Ivy League graduates. And they chose to live and stay in the North. And I grew up on Long Island and went to a public high school. I had been born in Manhattan and lived in Manhattan, where my mother grew up. My mother grew up in a very rigid and difficult situation. She had three brothers. They all died from various things. She was left quite alone when, this was in the early 1940s, my father went into the service, and she had me, and her parents, her father got dementia. She had to put him in a home. Her mother died, and her father died shortly thereafter. And there she was with me. You, on the other hand.
On the other hand, I am where I was born. I was born right here in Memphis, Tennessee, but that's because it was the closest big hospital. I grew up in the Arkansas Delta. My father was became a prominent and affluent cotton farmer in Northeast Arkansas. As far as education, in my father's generation, he was the only one of nine children that did not get to go to college. And he did not because of the family's financial situation. That also reflected my grandfather. My grandfather had the same thing. He ended up taking care of his brothers, sending both of his brothers to medical school at Vanderbilt. And talking to Pam, one of my great uncles was at Ellis Island interning in 1903. So he was up in New York and not in Tennessee. My mother grew up in Mississippi. My mother was the first person in her family who had the opportunity to go to college. So I look at my mother and my father, and my father's family played the violin. My mother's family, my grandfather played the fiddle. So that was the two differences in the group. But I grew up in a house full of books and a big library, and I've always wondered where this cotton farmer got all these books.
I wonder where he did.
I don't know. We had Chinese poetry. We had Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. We had Gandhi disciple. We had all kinds of books in our house. And I was the fifth or sixth child, and I stayed up in the library upstairs and read because I had four older brothers. So
self-protection.
Self-protection. But they were very protective of me. I was the first girl after four boys, and my parents waited 7 years, and then I came and had my sister in self-defense, so I would be able to walk and talk without help. So
I had a brother and a sister, both younger, so I was the oldest. And my parents moved out from Manhattan to Long Island on the North Shore, and that's where I grew up. And went to public high school, which is formative to me because it gave me a commitment to public education. It was an excellent school. I didn't know how really fine it was at the time, but it was. And that has stayed with me as I've reflected back and realized the benefits of that kind of education. Another thing that impacted me and has led me to understand other people's struggles more is that here's this wonderfully educated people, from my great uncle being the governor of Massachusetts on down to all this stuff, but my mother struggled. She came from a very authoritarian household. She always wanted to be an actress. And at the time, she acted off-Broadway with Frank Lovejoy and Basil Rathbone, if you've ever heard of them, and loved theater and loved acting. But that was not a, quote, suitable profession for a young woman. At that time, really virtually nothing was for her except to get a good education, marry, have children, support my father, her husband, be upstanding. And I think she had such an inner struggle going with that, that she got caught up in a very, she's a very social person, and she got caught up drinking. And gradually, that strongly impacted me and strongly impacted our family. My dad traveled quite a bit. He was a management consultant. And so he was gone, you know, maybe 1 week or 2 weeks a month during the week, and would come home, be a big celebration when he came home. But my mom then had us to raise, the three of us to raise. And I think I was rather a handful to her, though I loved her very much, and I felt that love in return. So how about you? Did you have any struggles?
I had struggles because, again, I was... was the first girl. But my biggest struggle was that was a person that took care of me when I was a child. She worked for my mother and father. She worked in her house. Her husband worked on the farm, was a tenant farmer, and lived right across the road out in the country from our house. And she was the dear heart of my life, and she is one of the main reasons I did Lynching Sites Project, because she has been, was a figure in my early life who nurtured me and took care of me. First words I ever said, her husband's name was Jack, and as he walked across our front yard back to his tenant house, she would greet him every day at noon. I would be sitting on the front porch in her lap, and I would say, "Hi, Jack." The very first words I ever said were her husband's name. And she was very dear to me. She died of cancer when I was 7, and I attended her funeral. And it was traumatic for me to lose someone like her, and because it was traumatic because she was very dear to me, and also because I came, neither one of my parents were very emotional at all. They were very self-contained, and I had only gone to nice white Methodist funerals where you weren't supposed to cry, and I went to a black funeral and lost it completely at that, and that made a great impact on my life. Several other things. I would ride with my daddy in the car all over. By this time, he had a large farm, and as a small child, I rode with him all over the farm and saw a lot of the people and saw how the different cultures worked, the different people lived, and never saw either one of my parents do anything mean or say anything mean, but it was obvious that there was a huge, huge, huge difference at that point in time in the state of Arkansas on a farm of the Bay people's economic wealth and prosperity. I also, when I was 16, this was the second time that I really got to be close to my father, that I drove, when he taught me how to drive one summer, and the summer before I turned 16, and I rode with him in the fields all over the farm. So it was a safe place for me to drive on the turn roads. I wasn't on the highway or even off the gravel road. But I learned a lot about him, and I learned a lot about what he did and who he was.
Those are wonderful memories. I mean, those are treasures. I remember my mom doing a great deal of volunteer work, and it was very important to her to stay involved in theater, so she was involved in a local group called the Glen Players and actually acted and actually directed the play Outward Bound. And it was a great treat for us to come to. We never came to the plays themselves, but we came to the dress rehearsals. She was very involved in women's clubs. She did the things that people socially active at that time did. And I think she really enjoyed them and did them well, but I just don't think she was complete. And part of her struggle, I think, was that her father, before he died, had hardening of the arteries, and so the money he had amassed as a lawyer and as the director of the Commission for Prevention and Vice in New York City, he lost his money, and he lost his position. And she married my dad, who would not work for the family company. His family, which was a business, a manufacturing business in Western Massachusetts that he had grown up with over ultimately totally 150 years.
Wow.
And she and my dad broke out on their own. That was one thing that was a positive. We always felt poorer than people around us. Our house out on Long Island was a little bit smaller. We shopped at John's Bargain Basement for clothes. My mom was not proud of that fact, but she didn't feel like she could take us to Lord & Taylor in Manhasset and buy things. We washed out. I remember in junior high school washing out socks because they were the certain kind of socks that kids wore, those bobby socks, and I only had two pairs. So one pair to wear, one pair to wash. I think it gave me something of an internal understanding of people who had less and how they felt. I think also I developed a serious spinal curvature, about 90 degrees, when I was about 12 and was taunted some, even by my younger sister a little bit, not much. I think she understood more, but by some friends, particularly guys, particularly if we were doing sports or had anything where there was a bathing suit or something involved where my back would show. And I remember my mom being very, I remember her lovingly being very protective. So when prom time came, she had squirreled away silver dollars and she would take me to buy the special dress that was needed for the prom. And a strap, my father would say, that is not necessary. She can just go. And my mother would say, no, she can't. She's going to have this and she's going to have it fixed so she feels good about how she looks. So I remember that. And then I went away to college. And I went to State University of New York at Potsdam to study music. Was a total dilettante, even though I'd sung and played timpani through high school. And all, but I changed my major and discovered English and teaching and absolutely loved it and became, in fact, a teacher.
Yeah.
A high school English teacher back on Long Island. I absolutely loved doing that. And you also, I remember you're saying.
Yes, yeah. Yes. I actually still stayed in Arkansas. I went to a liberal arts college in Arkansas. And I all through high school, I had one of these brains, I don't know, that I equally English and math, pretty even. But the English was always easy, and the English was more appropriate. But I went to this liberal arts college and majored in English, and minored in math, though. So I had the, after I graduated from college and married and moved to Memphis, Tennessee, I taught secondary English and math. I could do both. So, but, and I, you know, wrote some and did
that. What'd you write?
I did some poetry. Never published. This was all internal.
That's important.
Yeah.
that internal stuff we did.
It's very. So, yes. So we can move into Memphis, Tennessee.
We can.
So I moved to Memphis, Tennessee. I married my childhood sweetheart. My daughter always asked me why I married her daddy, because the marriage did not last. And my mother told her that I loved him so much that she was not going to stop us. So I did marry him, and we were together, and he was... He had been in Vietnam and was stationed in Memphis at Millington Naval Air Station, taught helicopter school, and I taught junior high school. And that's how I ended up in Memphis, which my whole life, Memphis had been the closest town, so it had always been the place to go to plays or good movies or to shop for special things. My mother sewed and made a lot of my clothes, but for special things, we came to Memphis.
I came to Memphis kicking and screaming. I had lived, after I got out of college, I lived in the Village, and that was the time of, you know, in the middle 60s, where life was very full in Greenwich Village, and I was trying to live a dual life, have fun and party at night, and teach during the day, because I would drive out to Long Island, too. West Hempstead High School and teach. I met a guy in 1969 as a result of being a teacher who had been in the Peace Corps with the person who was to soon become my husband. And he had kept talking about this guy from Tennessee, and I went, please, you know, in arrogance and ignorance of youth. You know, I didn't know anything about Memphis. Well, I met this guy at a party in New York, and we got engaged 2 weeks later, and we got married 4 months later. We've been married 50 years now. Something stuck, something about us and what we were seeking. And, yeah, we had our bumps along the way for sure, but it stuck. But we moved after we married to Chicago for a year, and I became the editor of a social issue magazine for high school students. And that was during the time in Chicago of the trial of the Chicago Seven and Native American people taking over Alcatraz. It broadened my horizons incredibly to do research at the University of Chicago and come back and work on writing articles every month, downsizing. I didn't write them, but I made them readable at a level for high school students. And the magazine was called Synopsis, and it would come out once a month, and every issue would be devoted to one cause. So it would be Native American rights or what we call welfare, the welfare system at the time, or financial things, or war. And the viewpoints would be about the problem from a fantastic array of opinions, from Spiro Agnew to the Black Panthers. And things in between. And the second part of the magazine would be devoted to solutions. And I discovered how difficult it was. Again, it would be from a broad viewpoint of what those solutions should be. And it would be, again, very, very wide. And I discovered how difficult, how easy it was to, I want to say complain, I want to say bitch and moan about problems, but not be ready or willing or able to find adequate solutions. Mm-hmm. And I found myself thinking about solutions for my life, solutions there. We stayed there a year, and then we moved to London for 2 years. And my husband, who's an architect, had a job there, and I didn't have a job, and I didn't know anyone. We lived on an English salary. We were, again, poor. We had no TV, we had no radio, we had no car, and we had no mail for more than 2 months because there was a generalized strike. Plus, it was November, and November in London can be pretty dismally gray and rainy, which it was that year. But I kind of, through grit and not sure quite how, but I overcame that and decided to study ESL, and I took a course. I was the only American in it for teaching English as a second language, and really thrived doing that. But we decided, after very careful deliberation, to come home after 2 years. We had thought about becoming British citizens, and we realized, both of us, through a lot of discussion, that we could not have the benefits that people born in Britain might have, and that we needed to come back and to see firsthand what was happening in our communities and in the United States. And so we came back. I thought we were going to be in Memphis a couple months, and this is 45, 46, 47 years later. We're in Memphis. It was difficult at first.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was hard because I didn't know anybody again. I kept going to places where I didn't know anybody and had to fit in. And just started working in a bead shop, managing a bead shop on Walker Avenue for kids at the University of Memphis. But then I got a job as the trainer of social workers for the West 20 counties of Tennessee. And my supervisor, Margie Kauser, I'm always indebted to her. She was the first woman supervisor who was Black that I had had. And I started to look at life in a different frame. I really hadn't been around Black people, African-American people very much at all. But it changed radically. Seeing how well-run at that time, I thought the Department of Human Services, then it was called the Department of Welfare, was. But how frustrated and how overwhelmed and how understaffed and underappreciated the workers were. So that was seminal for me to work there in terms of my life's mission and broadening. How did teaching and what did you do that affected you that way?
So here I'd grown up here. I'd always known that there were things were not equal and things were not, but I accepted the fact when I was in college at this small liberal arts college in Arkansas, the first two black students, this is a Methodist school. The first two black students were admitted that my senior year in 1967. And I was the resident assistant in the dorm. They were put in a senior girls' dorm for safety. I mean, nothing happened, but just to be sure, it was such a radical thing. So then I married, and then...
Did you have relationships with those?
Yes, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So that was probably my first equal type relationships with black people, and I'd been around them my whole life, but the cultural overhang was there growing up, mm-hmm. and the place my family had in that small town, just because of that. So it was several years. I mean, I was there, when Martin Luther King was killed, and I can remember that I knew about Martin Luther King. I had actually between my junior and senior year had been in London, been in England all summer with the Experiment in International Living, and was prepared by that group on what to say about racism and integration. And that had made me really think a lot more about that.
That's interesting.
Yeah. An awareness of how to present it to people, my feelings about it. I had to think about what my feelings were about it. And my feelings personally were, why not? But when Martin Luther King was killed, I thought it was awful. I was sad for him, but mainly I was scared. I was scared that there was going to be riots in Memphis. I was living out in the suburb in North Memphis. It was not until I taught at a black school 8 years later and saw the film, the Martin Luther King film, sitting there in the auditorium with an entirely all the students in the school, 7th through 12th grade, were black children, and that it finally dawned on me what was going on and how I felt about it and not what I wanted to do about it, but how and I knew, I'd known always, and probably because of my early relationship with the woman that took care of me. Her name was Maddie. That it wasn't right. That it wasn't right, and I needed to do something. And that I knew at that point that black women, particularly black women, had such strength and knowledge and wisdom. I had always known that, but that's when it became apparent at that point when I saw that film. And I began, as I changed careers and went into business.
I remember that when I was working at the welfare department, that households were often headed by black women,
yes.
Particularly grandmothers,
yes.
At that time. And that was new to me. I did not know that. I had not had any grounding in that. And I found myself in positions where I was the listener and the learner to a great extent. But it was very impactful. But I remember my mom's service that kind of said, you need to be doing something. I still didn't know what it was, so I went to work with the Arts Council here in Memphis as their assistant director and their grants administrator. And we had three grants, and one was an arts in the prison program. And we brought to the Shelby County Penal Farm, that's what it was called at the time, arts and literature. And I started to see dichotomies and complexities, and that people could be one thing in the eyes of some people 10 minutes and others, and something else in the eyes of other people. After working there, had two children, stayed home for a while, and then became the director, the assistant director of the World Cataract Lens Project, which brought me an opportunity to go to China and to Mexico and to see cultures and cultural differences there, and to see the poverty there. We were doing cataract surgery at the time, and I was administering the program, putting it together, and we'd bring physicians and nurses to Memphis to train. That project is still going on this many years later, and I'm still involved with them, and they operated for me. But it broadened my cultural understandings some more, and it kept deepening and deepening through when I became Leadership Memphis director years later. And it was a top program. It's still very active, has kept its community sense. To me, I began to see the total inequities in the black-white communities. Yes. But I began to see that, for me, life is very broad, and we need to include everybody in it. And my life's mission has evolved in that way. But it's evolved into bringing justice and understanding and the ability to listen and to talk and understand people of all kinds of other cultures. And I brought that into Leadership Memphis because we virtually didn't have any Asians in the program at that time, or Hispanic people. And so that was an active. I actively sought that out to make it not just this black-white thing all the time. I was there a total of 13 years when I retired. And since retirement, I thought, I don't want to be just sitting around. You know, so certain things have come up. One is the Lynching Sites Project. Yes. And I have loved the Lynching Sites Project because of the way that we try to approach what we are doing, which is a very sensitive, painful, difficult task, with humility and with a deep honor to everybody involved. And it's caused me to peel layers away and to really reflect on what I, as a white, privileged female, have and don't have. What are the things? What are ways that I can be of service? And what can I bring to the table? And how can we share it? And I know you came to Lynching Sites Project because of your deep commitment to.
Yes, yeah. So I had going back to my mother. I have not said that much about my mother. My mother was always not doing it with organizations in the local community, but a lot of individual work with people, regardless of color, and the lovely lady that took care of me was my mother's best friend. Was my mother's, but they were the same age, and I knew that she had cancer, she would call my daddy. And by that time, he was very busy, prominent, had a car that he did all his traveling around, and she would tell him to bring the car home. That Maddie's husband had to take her to the doctor, and he had to go get a work truck, and it was just too bad. And
my gosh.
That's the way that went. Her commitment to people was amazing. So the whole thing, as I lived in Memphis and worked mainly with children, I had a scout troop. I taught with black teachers. The more I was with, the more it was normalized, and I was put into places that I learned about people, and quit seeing so much difference and saw the similarities. Besides teaching and Girl Scouts and all this, before I did Lynching Sites Project, I was involved at a nonprofit here in Memphis that treated people with very serious health problems. And a woman that I worked there with and worked teaching GED to her and became her mentor, and a black woman, LaTanya is her name, and she has been an inspiration to me. Maddie in my early life and LaTanya in my later life have been two black women who have shown me what it is to be strong and courageous and kind and everything and do unbelievable things and still love, still love their families, even though their families are falling apart and having difficult times. LaTanya has told me several times that, you know, she doesn't know where some of her family came from.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
But she still helps. She still helps. But she has good boundaries. She has good. Anyway.
Your life meaning, if you stated in one sentence.
Well, to uplift people of color. To uplift, not just African American, but I've been in Memphis, Tennessee, so that's the main group.
And mine has been this interrelatedness of everybody with each other and interdependence of all people. And all of us with the earth and with nature, because there's a whole garden side I didn't talk about, but there's an earth mission side that is operant in my life too. And in addition to the Lynching Sites Project, MICA has become the Memphis Interfaith Coalition for Action and Hope. Our church is involved with that. And so education equity, bringing equity in education, in intercultural matters and economically, can build a healthy country and healthy people. And we're not there.
Yeah.
But through working together, I'm really happy to know you. I'm happy to know other people in Lynching Sites Project. It takes time.
It takes time. It's not a quick fix.
No quick fix. Uh-uh. Life is not a quick fix. And life is messy. Community building, I learned that in Leadership Memphis, is really messy business. And we might often be accused of, what did you do? That's the bottom line part. But the part that really happens, happens over years. Like with the relationships you had and with the relationships that I had in Leadership Memphis and have brought forward.
And the change that it has caused in me, that's where I noticed it
right,
the most.
Right. And my willingness to say, this isn't right. And to approach some women friends I have who say, why don't they get over it? To say, it's not over.
No.
It's not over. We have so much more work to
do.
And we can do it together. And how to do this without screaming at people or being angry and saying, what don't you realize? I mean, give it up. Look what's happened.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't work.
But it doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So here we are together.
Here we are.
Here we are in this wildly imperfect and joyously loving.
And there's some reason that I've been here in Memphis my whole life. So I realize, here I am.
And still. For me, Memphis has become my adopted hometown, even though our kids don't live here. But they're drawn back. Thanks.